Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to The Longest Night. We are a Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon show on the Podbreed Network. My name is Rob, and I have seen every single episode of Game of Thrones at least half a dozen times, and I've read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
My name is Lizzie. I've also seen every single episode of Game of Thrones, but I haven't read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
And my name's Jay. I have seen every single episode of Game of Thrones. I have read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin, and I've also read all five books in the Song of Ice and Fire series.
If you want to, you can find us on Twitter. We are at LongestNightGOT. That is at LongestNightGOT, although to be honest, it is just me on there talking about Game of Thrones. So like, if you want to come and see me rambling, then by all means, follow the page. I'll leave a link in the description as always. Our title music was written and provided by Edward Thomas, a friend of the podcast, and you can find all of his available work in the description as well. I also write for metro.co.uk. They're a cool, popular website who do news and shit like that. I write some stuff about House of the Dragon a few times a week. It's mostly just fluff, clickbaity SEO stuff. But hey, you know, it may be interesting to you. Who knows? Right, let's get going on this week's episode. This week, we are going to be discussing Season 1, Episode 8 of House of the Dragon, entitled The Lord of the Tides. It was written by Eileen Shim and directed by Jita Vasant Patel. It was first broadcast on the 9th of October, 2022, to an audience of whatever the fuck, who even cares? Just give me the figures. There is an ongoing battle here. I feel like they're going to finally release them for the season finale, and like they'll be like, oh, look how good our viewership figures are. But apparently cable viewership went down this weekend. So as I said last time, this is basically going to be a ransom. Every time that HBO don't release the full figures, I'm just going to read out the less impressive cable ones, like some evil podcast host. But anyway, Lizzie, what do we make of The Lord of the Tides?
Yeah, this might be my favourite episode so far, which I know I've said a couple of times, but the show does have a habit of, you know, improving week on week and, you know, surprising me when I don't expect it to. Like, with this one, I thought there was very little action to speak of, but still, like, chock full of tension. And in particular, obviously, Paddy Considine's final performance as Viserys is incredible from start to finish. Like, despite his obvious flaws and failures, both as a king and as a human being, you really do get the sense that this world will be much worse off without the presence of King Viserys. Mm. And I think that's just a testament to his performance in this episode.
Mm. Yeah. Jay, how about you?
Best episode so far. I'm in total agreement. I don't know that it's flawless, but I don't really care because what it was just a perfect version of what it was. It was, yeah, really quite emotional and moving. Everything really tied itself together. All of those bits that have been building up throughout the whole season all came to a head. The direction, the music, everything just worked, just plain and simple worked. I thought it was absolutely amazing. And I don't think anyone expected that the first season of House of the Dragon was going to essentially be the story of Viserys Targaryen, who's a fairly minor character who's just kind of part of a prologue to the proper story. And yet somehow the crew and Paddy Considine have like turned him into, clearly, if you look online, one of people's favorite characters of this whole world. And it's to be commended. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, I don't think it's my favorite episode so far, but I still really love it. Like, I think it's more of a testament to how much I've enjoyed episodes like Driftmark and, you know, like King of the Narrow Sea and things like that so far, that this isn't my favorite episode, because this is so good. Like, this is really, really excellent. I think it's an episode about, like, hiding wounds until they can no longer be hidden anymore, both physical and mental and psychological. And again, yeah, I mean, it was something I noticed in the first episode, to be honest. Like, when I watched it in Leicester Square, I came out of the cinema and, like, watched it at home and saw, like, you know, couple, you know, bits of, like, you know, what people were looking forward to with regards to House of the Dragon. And not many people were saying, oh, I'm really looking forward to, like, Paddy Considine's portrayal of King Viserys. Because, like, I've followed Paddy Considine on and off for a really long time. Like, and after the first episode came out, I wrote this really long piece in Metro about how, like, this will be the role that finally gives him the big international break that he's always really deserved. Because he's a I wouldn't even say he's a household name in the UK. A few people kind of know who he is, and they'll have recognised his face. And, you know, I think if you people are looking back and sort of revisiting things like Hot Fuzz and being like, oh, yeah, and Dead Man's Shoes, and, I mean, he wasn't in it, but directing it, Tyrannosaur with Olivia Colman in 2011, and Arctic Monkeys fans out there, the music video for Leave Before the Lights Come On, they, you know, they'll probably know who he is. But in America, I think a lot of the reaction to him was like, oh, cool, don't know who this guy is, like, you know, pretty cool. And I was like, yes, finally, he's going to get, like, a role that he can really get his teeth into, and this will be the thing that, like, gets him nominated for Emmys, and people will really talk him up after this, and his career, as good as it's already been, will really expand, and especially after this episode. And it was something that I've always thought, and then Miles McNutt kind of confirmed it, and then this episode doubly confirmed it, which is that as much as this show has had Rhaenyra on all the posters and has had Olivia Cooke, you know, on all the posters alongside Emma Darcy and Matt Smith being the big name on the paper and stuff, I always think that the show has anchored itself on Viserys, and now I'm curious to see what it anchors itself on as we go forward. Now that he's not there, there's a large vacuum to be filled.
Yeah, definitely. And you said in our chat, you know, you're not sure how it'll carry on. I think it's easy to forget. Like, people must have thought of that. I didn't watch Game of Thrones when it first came out, but people must have thought of that after season one as well.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, which is it's crazy to think about. But season one of Game of Thrones is the same thing. How do you build a show around around Sean Bean and Mark Addy, and then have them not be there for season two? How's that going to work? So I'm hoping we'll see a repeat of history with this, and that it'll just keep on growing and getting better.
The sea snake is strong.
No doubt. And yet I have seen blood fever overcome men half his age.
I will not suffer the talk of crows in my house, Faemond.
I love my brother, but we must be honest with ourselves. We may greet his ship to find him gone, and who will take the Driftwood throne?
My grandmother seems quite comfortable here.
She presides only in the absence of her husband. On his death, the seat passes
to Lucerys Velaryon, as is my lord husband's desire.
I am the sea snake's own blood, the closest kin he has left.
Be careful, good brother. None can take your words for treason.
In part one of the episode, 6 years after the death of Laenor Velaryon, his father, Lord Corlys, is gravely wounded in battle. This raises the question of the succession on the island of Driftmark. The current heir is Lucerys Velaryon, son of Princess Rhaenyra, but Corlys's brother, Vaemond, seeks to challenge Lucerys on the grounds that he is a bastard. Vaemond and Corlys's wife Rhaenys, along with her granddaughter Baela, journeyed to King's Landing to meet with Otto and Queen Alicent Hightower, who are ruling the realm due to the worsening health of King Viserys. At Dragonstone, Daemon has just discovered that Rhaenyra's dragon Syrax has laid 3 eggs when he receives a letter from Baela with the news. Daemon informs Rhaenyra, who is pregnant once more, and the pair take their family to the capital. Upon arrival, Viserys' condition has deteriorated significantly since the last time we saw him, with the king now unable to rise from his bed. Rhaenyra and Daemon introduce themselves and their new children, Aegon and Viserys. So we will start at Driftmark, where Vaemond is putting a case forward to be named as to be designated as the heir to the Driftmark throne. Lizzie, what notes have you got about the beginning section of Lord of the Tides?
I've actually got a question for you. Did you say that apparently there was going to be a scene where we see what happens to Corlys, but then this was scrapped?
Yes, there's a storyboard artist whose name escapes me, something Pescott, I think his name is. He has basically, yeah, admitted that though it was storyboarded, the scene where Corlys picks up his injury, but budget, time constraints, you know, the realities of making a TV show, they got in the way. And so it was replaced by Vaymond just explaining what had happened.
Okay, so I mean, I take it from the way that this is spoken is that he's not dead, he's just injured.
Injured and he's got an infection and he's ill.
Yeah, it seems interesting that they're kind of rushing to figure out who the current heir is if he's only injured and has an infection. It sounds kind of like they're preparing for the worst, I guess.
Yeah, they are.
Maybe the case in King's Landing makes them think, maybe we should do that, you know, just in case, because, hey, you know, we've seen what the consequences are of not doing that. But yeah, you do get the sense that there's like, it's not like a sadness that you sense in Driftmark, it's just this sense of unease, like the mood has kind of turned a little bit sour, and particularly like with Rhaenys and Vaemond, they don't seem to, I wouldn't say they hated each other or anything, but there doesn't seem to be like a warmth in their connection.
No, not at all.
It is just, it's cordial, but that's about the limit of it. And even later on, you know, when we'll get to it, but we see what happens to Vaemond. I note the lack of reaction from Rhaenys.
Yes, yeah, the lack of reaction from a few people, I think.
Yeah.
I find it quite interesting, though, that literally, like, you know, an episode or two ago, Corlys and Rhaenys were sat there, and Corlys was like, history does not remember blood, it remembers names. And now Vaemond is stood up there saying, history actually does remember blood.
Yeah.
yeah. I don't know if you've got any more on that, Jay.
I think it's something that runs as he appears throughout the rest of the episode, is that, like, he's kind of, it's a bit weird, because he is kind of portrayed like he's being somewhat unreasonable. I mean, he is kind of correct.
He's right. He's totally
like,
right.
He
yeah.
is right. Obviously, yeah. We as the audience are like, well, we want the characters we like to carry on doing stuff. But it is quite funny how, like, the whole show has to kind of, like, turn him into, not a villain, but a little bit of a dick, even though he is essentially correct. I do think that, I've said it a few times, I'll say it even more, I'm sure, as the show goes on, but I think Rhaenys is like the secret weapon of this show for me.
Yeah.
Because I love her, and I think just her sense of world weariness, which you got straight away in that first episode, is just really just right at the forefront again. And, you know, when you say, you know, it doesn't feel like, it feels kind of uneasy, I think that's kind of the thing. Rhaenys is kind of, she's worried that she's about to become adrift. Corlys has clearly been like a rock for her, and she's potentially going to be cast adrift, and she has
That's true.
Weigh up her options and be like, okay, well, if I'm going to have to pick a side, which side am I going on? I don't think she makes that decision until the absolute last moment in the throne room later on.
Yeah.
Mm. So yeah, I got that whole sense of like, yeah, he's very, very adamant in this is the right thing to do. He's very Stannis in that kind of way. And she's kind of not sure where she's falling.
A lot of people have kind of compared Vaemond to Ned Stark, because, like, it's just that Ned went about it in a very different way. The result was the same, which is that Ned finds out that the Queen's children are bastards.
Yeah.
And like, he goes, should probably tell somebody about this. But the way that it's framed and the way that Vaemond is kind of, like, portrayed, it's just like, he is right, but he's just being, it's kind of like the show's kind of turning to him and going like, you are right, but you have to be so obnoxious about it. I mean, God,
yeah.
Jesus. Yeah. I do feel a bit sorry for him in all of this. Syrax laying the three eggs. Just want to clarify, because I don't know if you two have thought this, but I've seen a few people online wondering, are those the eggs that Daenerys eventually gets? And it's not.
I've got literally that question on my notes.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's
okay.
Not. Yeah,
that does come up in Fire and Blood, but it's earlier than this story. It's an interesting story, that, but yeah.
Yeah, cool shot, though. Reminded me a little bit of the 27 Hours poster.
I thought that too, yeah.
Yeah, Daemon climbing down the gap in the valley, and then even just, like, getting to see how dragon eggs, are stored underground and, like, picking through that rock that then just kind of turns to, like, a really hot and sticky tar.
It really
reminds me of, like, the eggs and the facehuggers and things like that in Alien, definitely. At Dragonstone, where Daemon is speaking to Rhaenyra, I don't know if you've got anything, Lizzie, about sort of, like, the kids kind of, like, trying to learn High Valyrian and maybe trying to learn a language. I don't know if you picked up anything about that. It's fine if you didn't. It's kind of an incidental thing, but...
Not anything specifically about that. I did have a small note about, like, I do really like the new actors. I was a bit worried because I was like, oh, jeez. I'm only just got used to these actors last week and now we're losing them again.
Yeah.
But, I like this new crop. I think Jace in particular reminds me of, like, I want to say, like, a young Mark Hamill.
Ooh.
Okay.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, I get the sense that it's early days, but he might turn into one of the show's preeminent, quote unquote, good guys along the lines of like a Robb Stark, maybe, but I guess we'll see.
I'm really glad you're taking to them because I was a little bit worried because you really get to know the previous kids in episode 6 and 7, and then there's just another 6-year time jump, and I was a little bit worried about how that was going to go down. It leaps forward further than I thought it would, this episode. I thought it was only going to go forward like 4 years max, but it seems that we've really, really jumped ahead. The only reason I was asking about them learning High Valyrian is that I got asked, there's an article that's gone out today. I'll post a link to it in the show notes in Newsweek, where I was approached by one of the writers at Newsweek who was asking me. And that was the point that she asked me about. It was an article that they were writing about, which is like, why are they being made to learn High Valyrian when they're, you know, Targaryen? Shouldn't they already know this? And so I was sort of exploring the various options for why they might be teaching him and teaching him at this stage as opposed to when he was smaller and all sorts of things like that. So I went through various possibilities for that. Also managed to bring up one of my favourite little parts about Jaime Lannister, which is that he's dyslexic. It's just one of my favourite little things about Jaime Lannister, and I don't know why, but anyway. Rhaenyra's pregnant again. A second time in the show that we've seen, but this will be for what, the fourth time?
Sixth. There's a weird thing where they make it clear she's pregnant because he does the TV thing of putting his hand on her chair, on her stomach. I was like, oh, she's pregnant with the child, cool. And then they do like it's almost a reveal later where they're like, actually, that's her third child that she's with. Here are the two like more grown up kids. It's like, oh god, we are skipping. So I'm not sure why they kind of hid those, but
You only get them introduced when. Brilliant segue there, Jay. When they get to King's Landing, where they introduce Aegon and Viserys to King Viserys. But Jesus, Lizzie, I kind of knew what Viserys was going to be like in this episode because about 4 or 5 weeks ago, the House of the Dragon Snapchat thing put out a clip of like future episodes, and there was a screenshot that somebody had taken of Viserys in like his mask with no hair and like a walking stick and just like, you know, rotting from the inside out. But I don't know if I showed that to you.
You did.
Yeah, and so I was kind of wondering whether you were surprised by the condition that Viserys is in at this point in time.
So no, I wasn't surprised. I think I was more horrified to learn that it's 6 years since the last time we saw him. And even then, he looked like he was on death's door. Like, this is the thing, it's like the worst punishment of all is a slow death.
Absolutely, especially a slow death in that situation where you have no real control to speed. You have no option of speeding it up either.
No.
You know, it's not like now where they just kind of up the morphine and wait. Like, you know, it's just, really is nothing like that. It's horrible.
I saw an interesting thing when I was reading someone's thoughts on it where they said, I think it may actually have been, I know Paddy Considine put an Instagram post on like thanking people for like being, you know, with the, you know, praise and support that he's been getting as a result of this episode. I think it might have even been in that where he described it as his interpretation of how he managed to kind of stick around so long is it's kind of a way of showing him almost punishing himself for Emma's death. And kind of like maybe. he could have taken an easy way out a while ago, and he probably could do other things to maybe try and heal himself or maybe try and do this, but he kind of just kind of is like, you know, give me something for the pain.
Let me die.
But and it's kind of like I like that. I think that strengthens the thing even more to take that thing, to take that aspect where he's kind of, it's almost like a self-flagellation thing. It's like, I'm not gonna take the easy way out because my wife didn't get the easy way out. So it's kind of like a thing kind of in reference to that, which makes it all tie together at the end, I guess.
Yeah, it really does. And I think with Viserys' introduction, this is the start of the episode being about like trying to kind of conceal the true nature of wounds and things like that. Like you get Viserys with the bandage over his face, so you don't get the reveal yet that his eye is missing. Yeah. And that half of his face is rotted away. And also later in the episode, you get Rhaenyra with the scar on her arm trying to hide it from Alicent when they first greet each other again. And you also have, it's a little bit later in the episode, but Diana, the way that Alicent just kind of pays her to be quiet and gives her the moon tea. And there's all these things about like characters trying to hide various wounds that have been inflicted upon them. And I think there's a little thing in the second part of the episode that we'll get to in a second where Luke and Jace are talking to each other and they go over to that piece of the wall that's missing and it's kind of like, you know, he says, oh, you thought you could swing Morningstar or something like that and look what happened or something like that. And it's just this little thing like, it, you know, even a wound in a wall, it just never goes away. Like,
yeah.
It's something there always to remind you that this happened. And I think a lot of scars come up in this episode where even like, you know, Aemon, who's like the center of the episode at the end, I think, you know, he wears an eye patch because nobody wants to look at that, you know, that sort of thing. And yeah, it's just interesting that that's what this episode ends up being about, because by the end, it's all those wounds have been ripped open and everybody is aware of the wounds and things like that. Like even when Alicent is holding Rhaenyra by the wrist at the end and, you know, they're sort of like apologizing to each other for what happened at the family dinner and stuff like that. And everything's out in the open by the end. And, you know, Viserys has taken his mask off and stuff. And I think this is the beginning of it where you're clear that like it's made clear that whatever is under that bandage is not pretty. And then when they bring the kids over, and he's even managing to do things like say make little pathetic dad jokes like a name fit for a king and stuff like that. And it's just tragic looking at like all of his discolored teeth and the children just getting upset because he's there. And I love the way Paddy Considine communicates pain as well, because every time he does that little and then reaches for his eye and his head and just tries to cradle his head in his own hand, it's just so good. So good.
It is.
I don't know if you have any notes about sort of like Daemon and Rhaenyra's arrival, Lizzie.
Yeah. Not really. Only that you can tell who's in charge while Viserys is recovering, right?
Mm. Like, yeah, definitely.
A very cold welcome.
Yeah, I think there's that scene between Alicent and Daemon and Rhaenyra where Rhaenyra and is sort of asking Alicent about like, you know, how they're taking care of the king and stuff, and Alicent's like, oh, you know, we're giving him milk of the poppy, and Daemon's like, oh yes, sure, that was a merciful decision. Not just trying to keep the king's mind idle so that you and your dad can just, you know, scuttle about and run the place.
Yeah.
The one thing I will say about this, just this small council scene, I think this will be more important over the next couple of weeks. But I've noticed that a lot of characters that have been around and have never really been mentioned by name are suddenly being mentioned by name.
Yep.
Mm.
Yep.
like Lord Beesbury and Sir Harold Westerling. I mean, he's been, you know, Graham McTavish, he's been around, but like, you know, they're sort of like bringing all these characters back, and you also get Eric and Arik Cargill, who are going to become more important next week because they, they're in the trailers, like doing some practicing sword fighting and stuff. And so the Cargill twins, played by the same person, they're called Eric and Arik. God help people who don't have subtitles on. Just, never mind. but yeah, and they've also introduced a new maester as well. It seems that Maester Melos has passed away in the 6 years hence.
Yeah.
After Driftmark, we have a new maester who now sits on the small council. But yeah, I just wanted to sort of mention that we're suddenly mentioning people by name, and when a show suddenly starts doing that, they're probably going to become important soon.
Yeah, and I mean, Lord Beesbury's been there since like the third scene of the show or something. Like he was seeded early. And I think the other thing about that scene is that it's very clear that we've seen people chop and change on that small council, but I think the one in this episode makes it clear that almost everyone in the small council has either been placed there by Alicent or nudged into being there by Alicent or Otto. Maybe more so Otto. Because they're all kind of seem to be on their side. Also, I will point out that the person who does actually receive Rhaenyra and Daemon, I get the tongue tied, is Lord Caswell, who is the guy who they met on the stairs after she gave birth. He's been named. He's been named, and he might stick around. I like it. There's so much setup, and it's been really good at setting everything up for the future.
But what I worry about is what others might believe. You're alone with the prince, were you not?
Yes.
And no one else saw what happened between the two of you. If anyone else were to hear about this.
I haven't told anyone.
You told Sir Eric and Talia and now me. And though I believe you were not to blame, others might not be so trusting. They might think you were trying to besmirch the prince, or worse, that you're the sort of girl that might have enticed him in the first place. And you know what happens to girls like that.
I wouldn't dream of anything another one to anyone. It's right out of my life.
Queen Alicent meets with Diana, a maid who tells her that she has been sexually assaulted by Prince Aegon. Alicent gives Diana moon tea and pays her to stay quiet. Privately, Alicent chastises Aegon for his actions and disowns him. Alicent then meets with Rhaenyra and Daemon and informs them that she will be the one to choose the new heir to Driftmark. Vaemond Velaryon arrives in King's Landing shortly afterwards, as Aemond, now with an eye patch, trains with Sir Criston Cole. Otto Hightower and Vaemond then privately attempt to convince Alicent to name Vaemond as the heir to Driftmark, while Rhaenyra privately meets with Rhaenys in an attempt to convince her to support Lucerys' claim and to betroth Rhaena and Baela to Lucerys and Jacerys. Lizzie, the scene with Diana, I think this is where the episode really begins to, like, take off for me.
Oh, yeah. This is horrific. Like, it's so clear that Aegon, especially, has been bred for power and has never really been held accountable for his actions as a result. And we've already seen evidence of this in the form of his relationship with alcohol and treatment of staff members in the previous episode. So this is just, like an amplification of that. I was meaning to ask though, because you mentioned there that Alicent disowns him. I think that that's not literal. Like I thought that was just a kind of thing of saying, you know, no son of mine would do that.
Effectively, yes. Maybe the way I've interpreted it is a bit too literal and extreme, but yeah, basically, you are no son of mine, you are no child of mine. It's kind of like Tywin with Tyrion, you are no son of mine sort of thing, where it's just sort of a thing that you say, where it's like, I don't recognize myself in you, you have my genes, and yet. So, yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, as much as, you know, what Alicent does is pretty horrific as well, just, you know, giving her the moon tea and some hush money. It's also a question of, like, what can you really do? Like, he's your son. What are you going to do, fire him?
Yes, you're sacked from the job of being my son.
Yeah.
He's going to be the king. Like, we saw in that one of those previous episodes where she slaps him awake and is like, for God's sake, you're supposed to be the king. Yeah, I'm putting everything in you. Like, yeah. She can't just turn around and go, I'll just pick a different son now. I'll pick my other weird son.
Yeah, that's really an interesting moment, that where it you can see it dawn on Alicent that, like, this is the person that she's pushing to be king, but, like, she doesn't understand him. She just finds him monstrous. And yet,
yeah,
because she has family loyalty, that's what pushes her. I think Olivia Cooke in these two scenes is just fucking outstanding. Like, it's another moment again, just like when Rhaenyra was lactating in that small council meeting, where Alicent looks into Diana's eyes and recognizes pain woman to woman, but then what she wants to do and what's expected of her are two very different things, and she follows the what's expected of her line, which is, after having that moment where she gives her a hug and says, it's not your fault, I believe you, you know, don't worry about it, I'm not going to have you beheaded or anything like that, please don't panic. But then at the same time, the cool hand of brutal reality just kind of comes and sits on Diana's shoulder, where Alicent is like, but we do have to discuss the fact that you've said you won't tell anyone, but you've told me, you've told Talia, you've told someone else, you've told Sir Cargill, and now you've told, you know, and it's like, we're going to have to keep you quiet because it won't be good for you, and it won't be good for me, and it won't be good for Aegon. Here's some money. And it's, you can tell that what she wants to do is what she actually goes and does, which is just rip Aegon out of bed and be like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you're supposed to be the king. What the hell are you doing? And then, like, she gives Helena a big hug because she's like, Jesus Christ, you're married to this guy. And we did this to you. And this is what you have to deal with. But what ends up happening is that any kind of gender or sex related kinship with Diana is kind of overridden by what has to be done, or what Alicent feels has to be done. And then in the following scene, Olivia Cooke, the way that she goes from ranting and raving to, like, pure, like, icy rage and ice coolness, when she, her whole face shifts and she does the you are no child or you are no son of mine, and it reminded me a lot of how amazing Emilia Clarke was in that scene with Jon in the fourth episode of season 8 of Game of Thrones, where she's spelling it out to him really plainly what happens if he starts telling people about his true heritage. And she's saying, you know, no matter what you do, people are going to follow you. Like, you won't be able to control what happens if you start telling people. And John's like, well, I have to tell them, and we can live together. Don't worry, it's all fine. And then Daenerys is like, we can live together. I've just told you how. And it reminded me a lot of that, where Alicent has gone from ranting and raving about, like, how on earth could you do this, to just, like, cold, distant, like, ugh, disgust.
Yeah.
And it's really something.
Yeah, I think the thing of control is something that is clearly becoming a theme with her. Well, first of all, there's the thing of she has some newfound appreciation for the Seven, which she doesn't bring up. She doesn't bring up when she's chastising Aegon for his actions, but she does bring it up when she calms down later and she's more public facing. That's quite an interesting duality. but it's kind of that thing of, so the whole thing of Viserys kind of losing control of his family, I feel like Alicent's having that same problem. And as much as we get towards the end, and, you know, that, oh, we're going to kiss and make up, it's like, it's too late, mate. You've raised these kids. Like, these are the kids you've raised. You've got Sir Criston Cole teaching them how to be, you know, cold-blooded killers in the training yard. Yeah. You can't just suddenly go, oh, actually, I've changed my mind now. Like, you're losing your control, and no amount of seven-pointed stars is gonna stop your kids from being who you've raised them to be.
We met him a little earlier, and we mentioned him a little earlier, but I just wanted to ask about, Lizzie, your impressions of the new Aemond One-Eye, as he as he will soon be known.
He's terrifying. I love him, don't get me wrong, but he is... it's like that cold, unblinking eye and the pursed lips, just constantly, like, even when he's not looking, you feel him looking at you somehow.
Yeah, he's like Hot Squidward, but with an eye patch.
But
he's quite something, because a lot of people have been saying that, like, Aegon now feels like younger Aemond, and older Aemond now feels a little bit like what younger Aegon was like, and I kind of see that. But there is this theory amongst A Song of Ice and Fire fans, and it seems like the show has run with it, about how dragon riders age and how dragon riders take on aspects of their dragons. And there's this idea that because Aemond bonded with the oldest dragon in the world so young, that he's aging faster and that he's grown up faster, which I quite like, and the show doesn't really make explicit reference to that, but, like, it's a decent explanation for
the way things are. Yeah, it's even, you could even take it as just simply a visual thing of, like, Aegon, he might be older, but he's clearly less mature. And so it's kind of like a very instant way of kind of saying, oh, okay, he's kind of like the weedy one who's making quiet, hushed jokes so that no one can hear. Whereas Aemond might be younger, but boy, oh boy, that punchable face, and he is going to be in your face. Maybe that's how I see it.
And there's the scene I wanted to mention in the Godswood between Rhaenys and Rhaenyra. Jay, what you said before about Eve Best playing Rhaenys as a really world-weary woman really closely matches up to what I've said, which is Eve Best, and this is verbatim off my notepad, Eve Best plays Rhaenys like a woman who has seen too much to not be incredibly cynical. The stranger has visited me more times than I can count is something that she says in this episode, and it's a woman who has had enough, but carries on anyway.
Completely. At the end of that scene where, you know, Rhaenyra is like, hey, we could marry people together, you know, an alliance and stuff. I'll make your grandchildren, you know, the royal line and stuff like that. And she's just kind of like, oh, hun, you still think they're going to let you be queen? You haven't learned how this works yet, have you? You can offer me and my granddaughters all the thrones you want, but they ain't gonna get them, mate. Sorry. Like, it's just such a good performance.
Yeah, she really is. Really is wonderful.
It was ever my husband's will that Driftmark pass through Selenor to his true-born son, Lucerys Velaryon. His mind never changed, nor did my support of him. As a matter of fact, the Princess Rhaenyra has just informed me of her desire to marry her sons Jace and Luke to Lord Corlys's granddaughters, Baela and Rhaena. A proposal to which I heartily agree.
Well, the matter settled. Again, I hereby reaffirm Prince Lucerys of House Velaryon is heir to Driftmark, the Driftwood throne, and the next Lord of the Tides.
Later that night, Rhaenyra visits Viserys while he lies in bed. She expresses doubts about being his heir, and asks him whether he truly believes that Aegon's dream, the Song of Ice and Fire, is actually true. The next morning, Viserys commands Otto to arrange a family dinner. In the throne room, Vaemond and Rhaenyra are invited to state the respective claims to the throne of Driftmark. Unexpectedly, King Viserys arrives and slowly, painfully, takes his seat on the Iron Throne. He brings an end to the petitions, proclaims that the line of succession on Driftmark will remain the same, which means that Lucerys will inherit it, and agrees to the betrothal of Lucerys and Jacerys to Baela and Rhaenyra. Angered by this turn of events, Vaemon loudly proclaims Luke and Jace to be bastards and Rhaenyra a whore. As Viserys sentences Vaemon to have his tongue removed, Daemon suddenly slices Vaemon's head clean off. So the nighttime scene, we have thunder and lightning in King's Landing, would you believe? I think that's the first time that's ever happened. We've had rain this season, but thunder and lightning, well, that's a new one. I'm interested, I think from the first episode I've been interested in how this show portrays King's Landing.
Yeah.
As a living and breathing environment compared to Game of Thrones, where I think I said, like, Game of Thrones, King's Landing was mostly shot in the daytime. It was mostly full of life. You know, it was very sunny and, oh, this is where the royals are. Whereas with King's Landing, it's like everything looms over them just that bit more, and it's always a bit darker and a bit more oppressive as a place to be. Lizzie, while that thunder and lightning's crashing around outside, Viserys and Rhaenyra, well, I would say have a conversation. It's a bit one-sided, but what did you make of that scene?
Yeah, they have a chat. I think I noted earlier in the season that I was a little bit wary of the Song of Ice and Fire chat, just because I don't know if it is a little bit too much kind of nudge-nudge, wink-wink.
Yeah.
That kind of constant insinuation of, hey, it's that thing, you know, it's that thing. And, like, because it comes up later as well, and I'd say I think I maybe cottoned on more of what they were trying to get at there than here.
Mm.
But I think I'm still just a bit confused as to what this symbolism actually is, other than, is it just as simple as it is Aegon's dream, but it's a different Aegon, and we already know who that one is?
With the Song of Ice and Fire stuff, I think it's one of those things where House of the Dragon has included something that hasn't been mentioned in George R. R. Martin's books yet. And
right,
so
okay.
I just get the feeling that, like, if he ever gets around to, like, publishing those last two books, like, I think that might come into it, and then we'll sort of look and go, ah. I feel like this is George R. R. Martin's way of kind of, like, hinting towards little plot pieces in the Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire era books. But with this, I'm kind of preferring the way that they're using the dagger and the prophecy now compared to how they were at the future. It feels like without Game of Thrones, you would still have enough significance as to what the dagger and the prophecy means to Viserys. It's the thing that, like, it's the thing that defines him. He always has that dagger with him. It's never away from his side. Yeah. And, like, I think it's just that it's a reminder of, like, this represents everything that he's holding on to. He's trying to keep the kingdoms together so that if something falls apart, then they won't be able to deal with the threat from the north or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's Alicent, obviously, that misinterprets that at the end. But Rhaenyra, at the moment, is kind of like, this is a burden. I need to know if it's actually true, because then the burden is worth carrying. And if it's not true, and you're just kind of saying that to make me feel better, like, do I really need it? Like, do I really need this role, this burden, this being heir? And
yeah.
I think that's what she's trying to get at in that conversation. But obviously, because it's all a bit one-sided, and Paddy Considine is just brilliantly playing Viserys, going like, while he falls asleep, and she's crying and she's shaking her head and all this stuff, I think she just kind of knows that he's too far gone. She's not really talking to Viserys there. Like, Milk of the Poppy has just clouded his mind. I don't know what else you have about the Lizzie, the kind of pre-throne room stuff, that conversation. Jay, I don't know if you have anything about the Rhaenyra Viserys nighttime talk.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much to add from what you guys have said. I'd personally, it sounds brutal, I'd hard cut all this Song of Ice and Fire stuff out, because I think it's just a bit of a distraction.
Yeah,
you don't need the people in this story anyway. don't need a world-ending prophecy to fight over a throne. Like, I was okay with kind of like it being kind of a secret, you know, King Targaryen knowledge that, oh no, the Targaryens always need to be on the throne. How convenient that Aegon dreamt that it was his family that always had to be on the throne. Weird. Like, I liked that idea, but just, yeah, it's just another reference to it. It's just kind of like you're muddying the waters here a little bit and distracting us from the human drama that's in front of us.
Yeah.
The only other thing to say is that as soon as he said he was arranging a dinner, I jumped on the couch next to my two friends who haven't read the book, and I was like, oh god, we're getting the strong boys scene in this episode. I'm so excited.
So yeah, Lizzie, what's your makings of, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that happens in the throne room. We'll split it in half. Pun not intended. Mm-hmm. Viserys, first of all, I would say grand entrance, but it's a grand entrance by the time he gets to the throne. it's not that.
Yeah, I mean, I was also very excited by the prospect of another dinner scene, because they're always great in this universe. Like, you know, the Hound threatening to eat every fucking chicken in this room just comes to mind. What else? Some of the lavish wedding banquets in King's Landing. Maybe the Red Wedding if we're getting really desperate. But yeah, I almost want to say it's a beautiful scene. It's very bittersweet. It's like he's made this triumphant return, but he's so broken that he barely makes it across the room. And then you get like the big moment for me is when he sort of collapses on the stairs and Daemon has to be the one to pick him up and carry him that last few steps.
Yeah.
And am I right in saying that it was revealed this week that the crown dropping was actually improvised?
Yeah, I'm a little bit skeptical about that. I think it's one of those things where, like, because obviously, like, there are like 5 cuts after the crown falls off his head, and it's like they don't film with six cameras at once. Like, they maybe film with 2, but like, I think what probably happened was the first time they did the take through, the crown came off Paddy Considine's head, and then Matt Smith walked over in the middle of the cut, and then they thought, actually, we'll reset. Could you just do that? Could we build this in?
Yeah.
And then it becomes a part of the, you know, like, I think the way that they're talking about it, it's like, oh, we just kept the cameras rolling because what we were looking at was amazing. And I'm not quite sure that's how it went down, but it's a nice note. And I think it shows that Matt Smith understands that moment as well, because actors sometimes who were just kind of told to stand there, like, and just kind of pull a face and stuff, like, you know, they don't fully understand the moment from the perspective of the character who is moving through the screen, who is the focus of the camera. But Matt Smith really does in that moment, I think. Viserys' walk to the Iron Throne, it's kind of like, it begins as like, oh, here we go, Viserys' last ride, here we go, here's the one. And then the more that he keeps walking, it goes from this like big triumphant thing with like a grand big score and everything like that. It's just this quiet and desperate, and just like they're all kind of, you know, they're all kind of stood there watching, because, you know, in their universe, there's no music. And so they're all just kind of stood there watching the king go, ugh. Like that. And it kind of becomes a bit pathetic by the end, and I just feel awful for him. And then when Daemon's like, come on, like quietly just trying to maintain his dignity, it's just so sad. I don't know, Jay, if you want to come in on this.
For me, it was the thing of it, the overriding tragedy of it is this idea of, is it really now you're deciding to be like the king who's going to put his foot down and set everything to rights, and you're not physically up to it at this point. Like, that's the tragedy for me. Like, the first time I saw it was very cool and powerful. The second time I watched it, it was the second bit in the episode that got me emotional, because you know what's going to happen later on. But it was just that the way the music works is that thing of, it starts so strong and then does start to peter out as he kind of loses his abilities as he goes later on, and then you've got the moment of Daemon and everything. But yeah, for me, that was kind of the thing. It was the sure, this is great, and this is the most kingly thing you've done in ages, and you're finally taking charge, but you're about 2 hours from rotting to death. Like, again, the thing of control, the thing of things being too late, you've just left it too late, Viserys. Although it does have a great payoff with his first line once he sits, is just great, and it's a good transition from that kind of emotional, sweeping music, struggling man into like a Game of Thrones / Hot D drama sequence where he just says, I must admit to some confusion. I don't know why we're talking about a settled succession.
Yeah.
Such a great line.
And you can see Otto and Alicent's faces like, shit, plans rumbled. I mean, to be fair, Alicent is a little bit... She does express some doubt about putting Vaemond on the throne at Driftmark. She does express a little bit of doubt. It's Vaemond and Otto just kind of smiling at her in that small council scene, like...
Yeah.
You know, and the Driftmark's armies would be in full force, Your Grace, and stuff like that. And there's just, like, they smile at her in a way that, like, okay, I guess I can't say no. I really did feel something when Daemon picked up that crown and put it back on him. And, you know, because we kind of had a similar scene looking back, you know, in episode 4 where he gives up the crown to Viserys in that moment. And again, I think... And for me, it just kind of confirms that, like, the way that the marketing was in the very, very beginning, where there's that shot of Viserys saying, are you going to make me choose between my daughter and my brother? And, like, trying to build it up as, like, oh, it's going to be Daemon versus Rhaenyra for the throne. And, like, from the beginning, I think they've always left in pretty strong hints that, like, Daemon's not that interested in the Iron Throne. Like, little moments where they meant people mentioning the ruling and he just sort of giggles or, like, laughs. It's, like, it's not for him. Like, he likes all the security of being a Targaryen, but the responsibility of being king... has never really entered his head and as something that interests him. And I think these couple of scenes, like the one in episode 4 and this one, they've just confirmed it now that the show has stopped teasing people with something that was never going to happen. Like, it just... And it's nice that they've done it in... They've sealed it in quite a touching way where ultimately, as much as Daemon has teased Viserys and, you know, they've had their differences and stuff, ultimately, you know, Daemon sees Viserys as an older brother... And in this moment, it tries to maintain a level of dignity. Someone whose dignity does not get preserved, really, in this episode in any way is Mr. Vaemond, Vaemond Velaryon. Jay, how are you about the interpretation of this from the book? Because this is a little different to how things actually go down in that text.
Yeah, I'm struggling to think what are the actual details of it in the book. I can't, because we're getting to the point now where there's so many small changes that the everything's kind of getting a little bit muddied. I can't remember, how does it go down in the book?
Well, in the books I was just reading the other night, just kind of refreshing my memory, that Vaemond, I seem to remember he was challenging and spreading rumours. And I think Daemon is sent away by Princess Rhaenyra to seize him.
Oh, it's the dragon, isn't it?
It's the, yes, and then she has him beheaded, and then Syrax eats him. And there's some of the family members that have their tongues removed and stuff. But with this, I kind of love the way that they play it, because it's just like, oh! And then you see his tongue dangling in his head, and you think to yourself, oh, well, he kept his tongue in the end. And then Daemon speaks it aloud. And that promotional image that they released of Matt Smith kind of leaning on his sword, it was one of the first images that ever came out from the show. It turns out it's from this moment.
Yeah. it's funny. I think it's one of those things that, I don't know, I feel like you couldn't adapt the book version of that. Because just logistically, right, this is going to sound silly, but like if you're looking at that book and you're going, right, how do we do this scene? It's not very dramatic for him to be beheaded and then to have everyone, I guess, go outside and Everyone just kind of troops outside to where the dragon is so that it can just eat the carcass. And it's like, oh, okay, that's not very dramatic. We'd have to change the scene like 3 times and have extra locations.
Yeah.
I feel like there's going to be quite a few of those. Obviously, we know dragons are expensive and we know that lots of characters have dragons. So I feel like there's going to be quite a few bits like that where they're like, maybe let's bring some of the plot points down to earth slightly so that it's a bit cheaper for us to make and so that it makes a bit more dramatic sense. But yeah, the shock of it happening there and then, like, you know, mid word was good. But Damon got a very comic booky, don't even say that in a bad way, but a very comic booky style one liner of the "I'll have your tongue for this." He can keep his tongue.
It's funny because I have a friend who watches, like, you know, and reads comic books and stuff, and he's like, he watched all the Game of Thrones, but like he hasn't read Fire and Blood. And so, like, from the moment that Damon turned up, he's been like, Damon is like pure anime villain, and like being reminded of villains from like Final Fantasy and stuff. And so I think he'll enjoy that when he sits down to watch the episode. Lizzie, did it catch you by surprise? It caught Vayman by surprise.
Oh, so, yeah. I mean, well, that and the other very shocking thing was just the lack of reaction. There was a gasp and that's about it. Nobody was like, you know, going to the floor shouting, "Vayment!" Like, nobody seemed all that bothered. I know I only mentioned Frank Grimes in the previous episode, but it does feel very much like, you know, this guy, like you say, this guy was right, but he was being kind of a dick about it. And, well, if that's the way it has to be, you know, chat shit gets sliced, then so be it.
I guess who's gonna stand up to Damon, really? Like, yeah. Who in that situation is gonna,
well, true, is gonna and make like that jump? Again, what are you hoping to really achieve? There's nobody there fighting the Valarian side, I guess.
Yeah, he makes the mistake of going alone. I think that moment, I think Damon kind of gets away with it a little bit, because like if you openly call the queen, well, the heir to the throne, a whore, and just make an accusation like that, and use such an insult, even though you are right to call her children bastards, but not in the way that he does. It's kind of like, he doesn't take anybody to the side and go, listen, look, we all know that your children are not true-born Valarians, so how's about we do this? You know, it's like he gets very angry about it, makes a big public show of it as possible, and then Damon's like, all right, then I'll choose violence. I'll go along with this. If you want a public show, then we'll make a public show. If you want to be a spectacle, I will make you one. So there we go. Off goes his head.
Problem solved.
I think Rhaenys in this scene, when she makes the decision that she does, I think 3 things happen where she respects Corlys's wishes because she doesn't know whether Corlys is going to survive.
Yeah.
And so she respects his wishes by naming the children that he's loyal to as the heir, the child that he's loyal to as the heir to Driftmark. She secures her granddaughter's safety as well, because
that's true.
If Vaymond is the leader of Driftmark and the Hightowers are kind of on side with him, then suddenly, you know, Damon's children, they're not exactly going to be the safest of people. And it's her cousin's dying hope as well. Like, this is what Viserys wants. And so she backs him and ends up backing Rhaenyra at the same time.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite nice.
Yeah.
My own face. He's no longer a handsome one. If indeed it ever was. But tonight, I wish you to see me as I am. Not just a king, but your father, your brother, your husband, your grandsire, who may not, it seems, walk for much longer among you.
As Rhaenys visits the body of her brother-in-law as it is prepared by the 7 sisters, the family meal begins. King Viserys delivers a speech pleading for family unity between the Targaryens, Valyrians, and Hightowers. Many toasts are then given and the mood settles, and Viserys watches as his family members dance and laugh together. But after the king retires to bed, Luke and Jace laugh when a pig is presented to Aemond, causing Aemond and Aegon to start teasing Luke and Jace. A fight breaks out and Rhaenyra agrees to send her children home to Dragonstone before returning on her own. Elsewhere in King's Landing, the maid Talia meets with Missaria, who remarks that it has been quite a night in the castle. The family meal. Ah.
Yeah.
What conclusions have you... Well, I guess Viserys' role in it first, before Viserys goes to bed. I don't know if you have anything about that.
Well, yeah, Viserys' role, you do get this sense that, I think, like you said, Jay, it's like, it's this moment you've decided to be a king, to be a unifying force between people. And, well, like you say, it's too little too late. And as much as you do get that lovely brief moment where it seems like, if not warm, then at least cordial. And, you know, the music's playing and there's the dancing and people are feasting. There is just that relative moment of peace where he kind of looks around and it's a mix of, like, pride but also not fear but, as like, uncertainty. If that feeling of, you know, once I'm gone and that's going to be very soon by how I feel... This is all over. This ends with me. Like, this is the last moment that a lot of these people will get to experience any kind of peace. And it's only... I mean, he's maybe talking himself up a bit, but he could say that it's only because of me that they're not all, you know, stabbing each other to bits and punching each other up right now. Mm. It's just... And so you wonder if that this relative moment of peace is it just a show for him? Or is it genuine? Because I feel like it must be the former.
I think it's what I said earlier. It's genuine, but it's too late. These two mm-hmm. people, Rhaenyra and Alison, they can stand up and be as nice as they want to each other. They can admit their faults. They can apologize. They can make amends. They can touch each other on the arm and stuff, and it's all be fine and dandy. You've each brought up three kids to hate each other and to be paranoid of each other's stations and teasing each other, and you've been filling their heads with all kinds of stuff, your own stuff. It's all very well and good for you to decide to take that back at the last minute. You can't do that for your kids. And so while I do think it is genuine, it's tragic in that it just simply can't last. I think it's, for me... Yeah, I mean, it made me well up, that thing you mentioned when he does look around and he just does this, he closes his eyes and sighs. That just really, really got to me, because I was like, what great story you've told over these last 8 episodes of someone who just wanted everyone to get along, but wanted that so naively that you've let everything crumble around you. And as much as you've made so many bad decisions and done so many things wrong, I'm kind of happy that this is going to be your last memory of everyone kind of getting along, whether it was only for a second or not. And I do think that, like, I don't know, in another universe, if they'd have not brought their kids up to be dicks to each other, they probably might have gotten over their differences. I mean, there's loads of little things about the scene. Some of them I didn't even think of straight away, but on a second watch, he's, you know, Viserys does the really badass thing of, like, here's who I am. This is what I look like now.
Yeah.
Stop. Put all your facades and masks away from each other.
Mask off, literally. Like, yeah.
Literally mask off. he's blind on his right side, and the right side is where Alicent is, and he's kind of blind to that side's kind of scheming. You can think of it like that. You could think of it as my girlfriend thought, it's kind of, she interpreted it as how they're kind of seeing him. So on his right hand side you have Alison of the Greens, who are all kind of seeing him as not a monster, but as something that's kind of decrepit and old and on borrowed time, and
decaying,
when can I get the throne, dad? Whereas on the other side, Rhaenyra and the strong boys seem to see him as a man. They seem to see him as a granddad and as a father. I think this is, yeah, there's just so much going on. It's, yeah, it was my favourite scene of the episode.
Yeah, I think another thing on that, being blind on one side, is when he refers to Rhaenyra as his only child.
Yes.
In the episode, so like he doesn't really recognise, which is really sad, but like it's another, this scene is another one of those moments where these things about, you know, trying to hide wounds, like you can't really do it, like all these toasts are just kind of like papering over cracks that are still there, and even the tone of the toast, you can just tell that like they're not completely sincere, they're just kind of saying what they need to say. And then they get more and more, you know, they get closer and closer and closer to the speech that gets delivered once Viserys leaves the room.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, the moment that the music is playing and Helena is dancing with like one of the strong boys, and like they're just kind of laughing and joking, and like Otto and Rhaenyra share a laugh together, and like, you know, all these things, and you're just sort of like, oh, you know, here was this kind of fragile piece. You know, I think it's also a really tragic, like, this could have been possible. You know, it's kind of like people talk about that football game that German and Allied troops had on Christmas Day in 1914, where it's like, this is what it would have been like in another life, you know, in another universe. They're just boys. You've sent them out there to be cannon fodder, and this is what they would have been otherwise. They could have been friends, they could have got along, and with this it's kind of like, you know, all these wounds and the way that they've raised their children to be, it means that all this peace is only ever going to last momentarily. And I think they do that deliberately. The blocking of this scene is outstanding. I think some people might be a little bit irritated with the fact that very heavily unfocused bodies kind of move in front of the camera, but there's that great moment where you get a look at Viserys, and he's just kind of forming like half a smile. You think he's kind of, you know, laboring towards it, and then Helena moves in front of him, and by the time we can see Viserys again, he has his hand on the dagger, and as soon as he touches the dagger, he's kind of realizing like, well, it was maybe too fragile, and it was never really possible to hold all this together. Have I failed? And he just kind of, that's when the pain hits again, and he goes off to bed. And there's layers and layers and layers to this that remind me a lot of, like, you know, those kinds of things that you would get in Game of Thrones, where there's like huge depth of character through like entirely visual things.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's really, really something. And then like when he leaves, what happens afterwards is kind of like, well, the story in microcosm, which is just Viserys leaves the room and a fight breaks out.
That's the Dance of Dragons.
Yeah, pretty much. Viserys leaves and a fight breaks out. But the speech is the strong boy speech. Have at it, Jay. I know this means a lot to you.
I don't know why it stuck with me when I read it. It just, when I read it, I just thought it was a really cool line, a really cool scene. And I've always been looking forward to seeing it, because it kind of, in my memories of the book, it's the moment where like it's the snap, like that something, maybe you think could have had things get back together, maybe, but yeah, as soon as he does that, it's like, okay, everything's out on the table now, and you've got these kids who the bad blood runs too deep, and it's never going to be okay for them. And yeah, I think the actor's name escapes me. I should know it and look it up. But Amund.
Ewan Mitchell, I think.
Yes, I think his delivery of it is just fantastic. It has that air of, as you say, Viserys has left the room and a fight breaks out. It's this thing of like, well, the king's gone now, so suddenly I've got a bit more confidence and I've gotten a bit more cocky, and I can talk back to my mum, because who cares what's going to happen? The way he delivers it is great, and the goading, and I think the way that it's shot as the fight breaks out is really chaotic, which I think helps the moment as well, because it's like it completely breaks the serenity of what happened before. I really like Amund. New Amund is good. I'm happy. I'm happy with him.
Yeah, same. I don't know if you have a comment on the fight, Lizzie.
I think my other comment, I completely agree with you, Jay, by the way, but also there's that one moment just after the fight where Daemon kind of shoots that look at Aemond. Where it's just like, you know, I'm sort of proud of you, but that's my thing.
Yeah, and just to make it easy for you, Lizzie, we now have an Aemond, a Daemon, on top of Rhaenyra, Rhaenys,
Two Aegons.
At least we've not got Vaemond, you know.
Vaemond was also there, yeah, but he's gone now.
We lost one Viserys and gained another Viserys in the same episode.
Yeah, there's a character who's not been introduced in season one, but according to George R. R. Martin, is going to be introduced in season two, which is Daeron as well.
Daeron.
He is basically, so in the 10-year time jump, Viserys and Alicent had another child, which was Daeron, and he's gone off to be at Old Town, and that's where he is right now, and that's why no one's mentioning him.
Cool.
Basically. The other thing, I guess, from this part of the episode to take away is that they've named Talia because she's important, and here we are. She's a spy. So
yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, that's an interesting turn of events. I didn't expect that. So that's a bit of a show invention, I think, that like Talia is a mole for Missaria. I'm pretty sure that's a show invention. It's a pretty cool idea. Excited to see where it goes, because Talia features very heavily in the preview for next week's episode. So looking forward to that.
Oh, don't you remember? Aegon.
Our son.
His dream. The Song of Ice. And it is true. What he saw in the north. The prince that was promised.
I don't understand the sounds.
The prince.
Prince Aegon.
To unite the realm against the cold and the dark. It is you. You are the one.
In the final part of the episode, later that night, King Viserys lies in his bed as Alicent comes to visit him. When Alicent arrives, Viserys mistakes her for Rhaenyra and restarts the conversation Rhaenyra had with him earlier about Aegon, the threat from the north, the Song of Ice and Fire. Viserys, not knowing that he is speaking to Alicent, says, "You are the one," and refers to the prince that was promised. Unaware of Viserys' conversation with Rhaenyra, Alicent believes that Viserys is telling her that her son, Aegon, the prince, should be king instead. Alicent then leaves Viserys in bed, where he takes his final breaths. He says, "No more," and a tear forms in his eye. He then says, "My love," as the episode cuts to black. So, yeah, this is the pivotal scene that kind of kicks off all the shit that we're going to be watching over the next 4 or 5 years of our lives. Where Alicent... the war may have happened anyway, but this is, like, the igniting incident, I guess. Lizzie, how do we feel about the confusion?
How do I feel about the confusion? I feel very confused about the confusion. I don't know if that was the intent. But yeah, it's like, yeah, I feel like this can only end badly. And, you know, even just at, like, at the end of the dinner scene, it's like, oh God, here we go. But this chat about the Song of Ice and Fire is like, no, here we go. Like, this is going to be the sort of thing that can start a war based on just hearsay. And like, yeah. I don't suppose we're actually talking about Viserys' actual death yet, but just the stuff around it.
Well, you can talk about his actual death if you like.
I mean, I've not got much to talk about. I think it kind of speaks for itself. It's really beautifully done. And you do get, like, I'd say I'm agnostic at best, but you do sort of get that sense of believing, like, if there is an afterlife, or if, you know, if he's just had enough milk of the poppy to help him start seeing nice things, that maybe Emma kind of made an appearance in his thoughts.
Yeah. Paddy Considine has credited Sean Brooke with really influencing how his role developed and given him something to anchor it on, and how appropriate that it ends this way with the ring. And
something I think you've mentioned, Jay, in the dinner scene of like he's, or no, it might have been you, Rob, about how like he starts thinking about his legacy and was he a good king, and that sort of sets off his pain. It's like he has, because of what's just happened at the dinner, it's like he's had a temporary sort of reprieve from that.
Yeah.
And that allows him to just slip away.
It's the tear in the eye that kind of does it for me, where he's like, I'm exhausted, like, I'm done. Wanting to do nothing now. But it's just really tragic, because like just beforehand you get that moment with Rhaenyra and Alicent. Emma Darcy and Olivia Cooke have both spoken about this scene, where Emma Darcy says, we had an amazing conversation in advance of shooting the episode about it being sort of set in a hospice for the dying of King Viserys. Proximity to death can alter your chain of priorities. It offers a canvas for forgiveness where there wasn't one previously. Going in, we really wanted to make sure that the moment at the end felt honest, that we could buy that these two people get there. It's not an all is forgiven moment, but it's a gesture to forgiveness. And Olivia Cooke says they're really seeing each other for the first time since they were children. Probably since the first time Rhaenyra found out that Alicent was marrying her dad. It's unification in grief and recognizing each other's inner child in this loss. And so I get that from that scene, but like when it comes to Viserys thinking that Alicent is Rhaenyra, and just like, and Rhaenyra's like, oh, this was his dying wish. Because obviously Alicent has never been told about the dagger or the, you know, its significance, or like the Song of Ice and Fire and stuff. And so she's just listening to a guy going on like, Aegon, Aegon, the prince that was promised, Aegon. And she's like, you mean our son? Yes, the prince who was promised. And like, it just, you would.
The pronoun game again.
What was that, sorry?
It's the pronoun game again.
Yeah, exactly.
Not being specific enough.
Yeah, and I don't blame Viserys in that moment, because his mind is a million miles away. It's on the edge of not being a mind anymore. And so the thing with this, though, that I really like is, where you were saying, Lizzie, that you were agnostic, I thought you were going to go into talking about your allegiances on House of the Dragon, because I feel a little bit like the show has done more work to communicate the slightly underhanded nature of the Greens sometimes. They have come across worse, more power-hungry, like they're the ones upending the order, if you will. And I've been a little bit uncomfortable with that so far, because I want my Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon stuff to be a bit more even-handed. Like, I'm not a stan. I don't stan the Greens. Like, the stans on both sides of the conversation annoy the fuck out of me.
Yeah.
And if you can't tell the difference that, like, they're fictional characters and, like, they're not real, and that you're getting really angry with people on the other people on the internet who like a fictional person more than you do, then, I don't know, evaluate a few things. But, like, I was getting a little bit worried that the Greens were going to be cast as, like, the villains of the story. Not because I like the Greens, but just because I like how even-handed Game of Thrones was, where, like, it had one villain, which was the Night King. Everybody else was just kind of like a pretender, an actor, somebody doing things, because, you know, I always think the question that hangs over all of Game of Thrones is, like, how far is too far in pursuit of the greater good? Like, how far are you going to push it to put your vision onto the world? And I kind of like the fact that House of the Dragon's getting close to this, but it's not close enough for me, but until this moment where Alicent now genuinely believes that not only are her children in danger if Rhaenyra takes the throne, but that it was her husband's dying wish to have their son on the throne. Like, I don't know whether she genuinely believes it or whether she, like, just kind of convinces herself because it's convenient, but either way, it gives her a rational motivation to pursue what she pursues next and do what she does next, and make her next moves, and what we see from now until the end of the show. Like, why did she do what she did? Why didn't she make way for Rhaenyra? Why did she push Aegon towards the throne? And this is enough of a reason for me to think, like, they're going to start forgiving the Greens over the next bit of time in the show. I think they're going to start working on rehabilitating the Greens ever so slightly over the next bit, And Jay will know why, because there are future events, you know, coming up where we'll very much sympathise with the Greens and things like that. And I have a feeling that next week, the episode is not going to feature any of the Blacks.
Yeah, I think so.
The episode is just called The Green Council. And I think it's just going to be entirely King's Landing. Alicent's going to be at the centre of it, running it all. And I'm curious to see what they do when we're not seeing things from Rhaenyra's perspective.
Just really quickly, because I know you pulled me up on the agnostic thing, and that was more like, I don't want to make this a discussion about religion, but I've always been slightly uneasy of that thing of like, oh, they're in a better place now, or oh, I guess they saw like Emma welcoming him in. Like, I don't know, that doesn't really. I think what I love about Game of Thrones is something we've discussed previously, where it's like they have that honest discussion about death, where it is just like there's nothing. When you die, it's just
when
nothing.
When John goes, yeah.
Yeah.
I like to think that whether he sees Emma or not is, well, we never see it, so it's kind of like left open to interpretation. I think it's just like he probably imagines that he sees her and that's enough. Like,
yeah, of course, yeah.
I think that's probably enough. I don't think the show hints towards an actual afterlife. I think the show is pretty realistic with that kind of stuff. Jay, you know, obviously, like me, you've read how this goes down in the books with, like, Viserys regaling the children about the days of old and then having a sleep and then never waking up again and stuff. And, like, the show's version of it is just so much more brutal and nasty and withering and pathetic and sad. Don't know what you made of the interpretation.
I think it's the thing you've always got to keep coming back to is that Fire and Blood is very explicitly written as from a first person perspective. There is someone in the world who is reading books and has heard stories and is collecting them together and trying to be neutral but failing very often to be neutral, so any changes can always be chalked up to, okay, well, we, you know, that person didn't know how things go down. And actually, it's kind of actually going to make the book maybe even more interesting to go back to, because when we know what did actually happen or have a better idea of what did actually happen, it then makes us think, okay, well, how did the change, how did that story then happen? So if we know that Viserys, you know, died in squalor, that means that when the maester who wrote the book wrote it, how did that story of Viserys just telling a story to his children get passed down? Like, where does that come from?
Yeah.
You know, how does history become written and rewritten? You know, victors, losers, wars, and all that kind of thing. I think that's what's really interesting. But it is a far more brutal one. And I think you're probably right in that next week's going to be a bit of a battle episode for the Greens. And then it may even be that the one after ends up being the same thing but for the Blacks. Not sure. I feel like we got a good idea how this is going to go down, but I do think that we're going to start seeing more sympathy for the other side, because I'm with you on that, and that we do need it to even out a little bit, because I think it's very easy to be on Rhaenyra and Daemon's side at the moment.
Yeah, I think the scene with Viserys walking into the throne room is a really good example of that, where it's like, oh, Viserys has come to rescue Rhaenyra from the hideous evil Greens, trying to mess with things. You know, I think it's just difficult because, like, Otto Hightower's on the Green side, and so you're like, ugh. But also, Daemon is on the Black side. But
yeah, and he's not good. He's Matt Smith, but he's not good.
Yeah,
I know what you mean. I kind of want a bit more sympathy for the Greens, just to make it a bit more even-handed, but hey. All right then, Lizzie, I want your line of the episode.
I'll go for a short one. We've already mentioned it, but I'll go with, he can keep his tongue.
A good one.
Yes, he definitely did as well. Your loser this week, Lizzie.
My loser, I was between Aemond and Vaemond. What I'm going to do is I'll go with two for the road this week. So my loser of the week is Vaemond Velaryon.
Okay, yeah, no problem. And I guess your winner is going to be someone that we've talked about a lot this week.
Of course. My winner of the week is Viserys Targaryen.
Ah. Well, there he goes. And another Viserys comes in his place. But yeah, off he goes, and I'm very glad that Paddy Considine got to do this role. I can't really imagine anybody else as him.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, then, we'll be back this time next week for Season 1, Episode 9. We're almost there. The Green Council. We will see you next week, everyone.
See ya.
Bye-bye.